This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are you ready for real disaster news? If the warming currents in the North Atlantic weaken or collapse, Ireland, England, and North Europe will become stormy and cold, even as the world warms. Northern forests and agriculture around the world would suffer. A collapse of the ocean system known as AMOC has happened before. A new study suggests that destabilization could come again soon, even in this decade.
Now, we don't know if tomorrow is scheduled, so we want to be sure that we have enough money to enjoy our lifestyle today.
Look, there's been a lot of sensational, overblown reporting about an AMOC collapse, starting with the science fiction movie The Day After Tomorrow. It's not like that. In a few minutes, you will hear directly from an author of that study in Nature Communications, Professor Suzanne Ditlevson. All this comes in a time of unprecedented climate chaos. Extreme super events are piling on, popping up around the world in the same week. Slovenia was just wrecked by an extreme rain, with floods expected to pour into Croatia. As I record this, the UK is bracing for a life-threatening storm system. 3 months' worth of rain fell on northern China in 40 hours, flooding Beijing as never before. That was just a blip in the news, but it will take years to recover. Iranians are used to high heat, but the whole country was ordered to shut down for 2 days to save lives during an extreme heat event. In South Korea, 600 scouts needed medical treatment for heat exhaustion. Japan was lashed with record heat and dangerous storms at the same time. Almost unreported, there was a winter heat wave in South America. Temperatures over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 37 C, were reported in Chile. Some records reaching right up into the high Andes. For perspective, the start of August in the southern hemisphere is like the beginning of February in the north. It should be cold. High heat has never come this early in their season. The weather has gone insane. But don't think an ocean circulation collapse could be a good thing for the UK, Europe, or anywhere else. A bit later, I will examine sources explaining the impacts. Right now, let's get to the news about when the North Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, AMOC, could change to a state not seen on Earth for at least 12,000 years.
Radio EcoShock.
If the warming currents in the North Atlantic weaken or collapse, Ireland, England, and Northern Europe would become harder places to live. Northern forests around the world could change as the impacts ripple out globally. A collapse of the ocean system known as AMOC has happened before, and now scientists worry that destabilization could come again soon. On July 25th, the journal Nature Communications published a paper called Warning of a Forthcoming Collapse of the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. The authors are Peter and Suzanne Ditlevson. Co-author Suzanne is professor of mathematics at the Niels Bohr Institute at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. From Copenhagen, Suzanne Ditlevson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. Just one correction. I am from Institute of Mathematical Sciences at University of Copenhagen. It's my brother Peter that's from the Niels Bohr Institute.
Okay, I'm glad we got that straightened out. Suppose the impacts of global warming break down that key system called AMOC. What might that mean in general terms for listeners in Ireland, the UK, and Northern Europe, and maybe even your own Denmark?
Well, it will mean that it will become colder in our area, because this is a current system that exchanges heat from the tropical areas up towards the north along the west coast of Europe and makes that more warmer. And if that one breaks down, we suppose that it will become colder. We suppose that there will be globally much more wild weather. It will be more stormy. Probably the precipitation patterns will change. So places where there were before a lot of precipitation might be have much less and might be have dry out. I just have to say that our paper actually does not deal with what happens after the breakdown. So our paper is about what happens up to the breakdown and estimation of this possible collapse of the AMOC. And also, it's quite difficult actually to know what will happen if the AMOC collapses, because we don't really have any data that can tell us exactly what will happen. So we have to rely on models, and we have to rely on simulation of these models. So this AMOC has two stable states, or it's believed to have two quasi-stationary states, statistically stable states, an off state and an off. This on state we have had for more than 12,000 years. So everything that we know from modern times, after we had agriculture and civilizations and building larger cities, etc., that is with the climate more or less as we have today with this on mode. And the off mode, where we no longer have this exchange of heat that will heat up the tropical areas and it will cool down in the North Atlantic regions. And this does not happen in the Pacific Ocean. And this is because in the Pacific Ocean, there is not such a pump. There's some currents still. But Alaska and Canada is much colder than Western Europe, even though if we should have more or less the same climate for the altitude. However, exactly because of this AMOC, we have this more warm weather that we might lose if the AMOC collapses.
A key problem you address in your new paper, AMOC currents have only been measured accurately since about 2004. We have barely 20 years of records in a system we think can change radically. How did you approach this uncertainty?
Well, that uncertainty was really difficult to deal with because, of course, you can never do better predictions or better models that you have data for. So the data will kind of decide the quality of your predictions. However, 20 years of data is not enough to really make a statistical analysis of such complicated long-term system. So we can see since 2004 that it seems to have weakened. However, there is no way with such a short time series to really judge whether this weakening is just natural fluctuations or might it be due to climate changes. So what we did instead was to look for historical data that do not have the same quality because we didn't have ways of measuring back in time. So they don't have the same quality, but they are thought of being fingerprints of the AMOC. So what we're using is in an area that's called the Sugtala Gyre, which is south and east of Greenland. And this is thought to be a fingerprint of the AMOC, the surface temperature. Why is that? That is because this exchange of water, where warm water flows northwards in the surface, and then around this area it will cool down, and it is salty and colder, and that is warmer water, and the warmer water will sink down, and that is actually what's maintaining the pump. So it sinks down, and then it travels back at a couple of kilometers of depth in the ocean. Now, if you imagine that this pump stops or it becomes weaker, that means that less water, warm water, is brought up towards this subpolar gyre. And that means that a decrease in temperature could be a weakening of this AMOC. However, it's not that simple because on top of that, we have global warming. And global warming is even amplified in the Arctic. So it's even worse than the general global warming in that area. So what we did was correcting for the global warming by subtracting. And we did a slightly different subtraction than what has been done before in these fingerprints. And that's because of this amplification. So normally you would subtract one time, and we actually subtracted twice the global warming. Then that means now that we have historical data from 150 years back. So we start actually already in 1870, and then we have monthly data of this, let's call it the AMOT fingerprint. Now, that means that we have data from before industrial times. So we have from a time before global warming started, and we can make an analysis where we can understand what the distribution under natural circumstances should be. So that is kind of our baseline. So we have a baseline of what we believe the AMOP in a healthy state should be. And then we can look at how that changes. And this is called early warning signals. So let me explain. When this AMOC loses its strength, then the variance increases. The variance is the variability. And that is because this system has what we call a tipping point. This AMOC is a highly nonlinear system, and it has these two, it's believed to have these two stable states. And it can suddenly switch from one state to another. And once it switches from one state to the other, to the off mode, it will not be irreversible, but it will be irreversible in a time scale of a lifetime, let's say. So that means that basically we cannot go back. So you push the system a little bit, and you might be able to retract a little bit your pushing. So say you have global warming, and the global warming makes the ice sheet in Greenland melt. And when that melts, it brings more fresh water into the ocean, into this subpolar gyre. And that means the water becomes less salty, so that is, and then it does not sink. So this is kind of the driver of weakening the AMOC. But that is caused by global warming. So we can go push a little bit with the global warming, and it can still kind of react and come back to a healthy state. But if we push too much, it will kind of pass the state and go to the other state. And then even if we retract a little bit, we are not able to go back. So this is a tipping point. It's not a linear change. So we are scared of passing this tipping point, because then that is what we call the collapse of the AMOC.
We've covered quite a bit there. Now, it's interesting that you raise the issue of the pump that is really part of the great global conveyor belt of ocean water that circles around the world, because in April I talked with Dr. Matthew England from the Center for Antarctic Science in Sydney, and his paper warned a decline of ocean overturning in Antarctica is already taking place and could change state within a single lifetime. And so it's my understanding that Antarctic overturning is also a major driver of the conveyor belt that goes all the way up to the North Atlantic Exchange. And I worry that European scientists and certainly journalists have not really looked at the connections between the southern pump in Antarctica and the northern pump that we're talking about in AMOC.
That sounds very interesting. We haven't looked at that either. But that sounds very interesting, and that might very well be. So what we did was something new that has not really been done in this way before. And I think that is why we get an earlier, let's say, prediction for when it possibly might collapse. I mean, I think it's very interesting that you say there in the south that it might actually collapse within a lifetime, because that has been thought that that would not happen to the AMOC. That it's the IPCC has predicted that a collapse is highly unlikely to happen in this century. And that means that we are at odds. The prediction that Peter and I did is at odds with this prediction, because it's much earlier that we have. But the difference in what we are doing is that we look at it from a database. So we look at the data and see what that does. So the IPCC reports, they are based on models. On huge, very detailed climate models with all the mechanisms that we know are there. But also because they are so big, they contain a lot of variables, they contain a lot of parameters, and just slight imprecisions in that might actually change. That is the first thing that is problematic with the models. So I like the models very much, and I also trust very much the IPCC report. So that is not our point. The point is that the models are able to answer certain questions, but there are other questions they might not be able to answer. We believe, or Peter and I, we believe that these models that are the basis of the IPCC report are slightly too conservative. They are built upon what we know from the climate for the last 100 years. So they might not have enough nonlinearity to actually capture what is happening to the AMOC. We don't know, but that is something we have been discussing a lot, Peter and I, why it is that our predictions come so much earlier than the IPCC. And that is one of the ideas that maybe that is why they are simply not nonlinear enough. So we took a completely different approach looking at the data. And what happens when you have such a tipping point is the following. When you approach the tipping point, the system loses what is called resilience, and it has this critical slowing down. So loss of resilience means that it's not really able to come back to a healthy state if it is perturbed. So you can kind of compare it with, if you imagine a healthy person, you have 37 Celsius degrees in the body, and if you get too warm, you sweat, and if you get too cold, you burn sugar, and in that way, you maintain your temperature. But now imagine when you get sick, then suddenly you get fever, the temperature starts to fluctuate much more. There's much more variability. There's much more variance. You're not able to maintain the temperature at where it should be. It's a little bit the same that we are looking at in this tipping point that we are approaching or that we are moving towards. Then the variance increases. The system is not able to recover as fast as it was earlier. And this is exactly what we are looking at. So we are looking not at the mean value or at the level. So we do see a weakening, but that weakening could be because of just natural fluctuations. And we don't know what the level is for a possible collapse. So instead, we look at these signs that is called early warning signals. We look at these signs that appear when you are approaching such a tipping point, also called a bifurcation. To be technical, it's a saddle mode bifurcation. So we have this increase of variance and also increase of something called autocorrelation. So we looked at that, and then we realized the following. When you have such a tipping point, this type of tipping point, I mean, we believe that it's a saddle mode bifurcation. Of course, we might also be wrong that the system is actually not governed by a saddle mode bifurcation, but there are many people, not everyone, but there are many people that think that that is the case. So when you have such a saddle mode bifurcation, it's universal. So what do I mean by universal? I mean that any system that has such a bifurcation, whatever the system is, it could be in economics, it could be in climate, it could be in ecology, it could be in physiology. All the details are different. But when you come to the tipping or to this bifurcation point, they're all the same. It's universal. And we use this universal way of behavior of the system to recognize whether it is moving towards this tipping point and also when that tipping point in that case would happen. So maybe it sounds a little bit like magic, and also actually in the beginning when we started having these ideas, we thought it was kind of magic, but you can think about it like in a phase transition. You can have a phase transition of elements. So for example, water going from ice to liquid water. So that's a phase transition. But every element do the same. So you can have mercury or glass or even stone. They have all the details different, and they do it all at different temperatures, et cetera, et cetera. But the phase transition itself, when it melts, it's the same for all of them.
I should clarify for listeners, you've been talking about bifurcation, which is not a word many people use, and it generally means to split into two. So we're sort of talking about coming to a fork in the road in the behavior of this large Atlantic system, which has been in one state now but could go to another. But in a new paper, and I think you've been talking about this, it's not yet published, Johannes Lohmann and colleagues propose that there are intermediate steps and early warning steps, as you say. But even those intermediate steps, he says, are also abrupt. So we could go down in steps, or could it collapse to a new low state precipitously? Do we know?
Well, from our study, we cannot see it. So the only thing we can see is that there is a tipping point. And whether that we can say nothing about what is on the other side of the tipping point. I'm convinced that it will be something abrupt, but whether it will be in steps, so how abrupt it will be, how big a step, we cannot say anything about that. So our method does not work for that. So there's no way we can use this method to say this. And I know there are lots of discussion of what will actually happen. There are some paleoclimatic records from the ice ages. It seems like there were two states of the AMOC, the on and the off mode. But of course, that was during the ice ages, and we have a completely different climate now. So I would say we don't know whether there are intermediate steps also. So we cannot say that. We cannot.
Suzanne Ditlevsen, you're not a climate scientist per se, but a respected professor of mathematics. How did you get drawn into this contentious question of what will happen to the North Atlantic currents?
Well, it's really true. I am not a climate scientist, and I hope I didn't say anything wrong. My brother is a climate scientist, so that's Peter, and that's a co-author of the paper. And this came about because we often have many scientific discussions, and you know, even when we just have having fun, we're having scientific discussions. And this came about because Peter is leading this big center of tipping points, TPES, it's called, the tipping points in the Earth system. And he has been working with these early warning signals and trying to not only detect that there are early warning signals, which other people also have done, but he was bothered by the fact that there was not really statistical significance or evaluation of the statistical significance to the results. And secondly, he also got this very simple idea in a very ad hoc way to extrapolate from these early warning signals towards when the tipping point can be expected. He therefore contacted me, and we started to discuss it with me because I'm a professor of statistics, and I understand all the statistics, and I can say something about whether we can trust results or not. And then we just started working together and discussing and finding out how to do this. Because so in our paper, we present kind of two methods how to do it. So there's this simple, intuitively easy to understand method where we use the variance in itself. So we use the moment and simply predict when it becomes infinity. That can also be good. The problem is that estimator, so now it also becomes a little technical. The estimator, when we do that, is actually not very well behaved. It actually has infinite variance. So an estimator is a random variable. And this random variable has a variance. And you would normally want that variance to be as small as possible because that means that the estimate that you get is more precise. But that way he did it actually led to an estimator with infinite variance. So I really chewed on the problem, and we found another way of doing it that was more robust, more statistically sound. It's a little more complicated, a little less intuitive what's going on. But the beauty of it was actually that when we estimated first with this, let me call it the moment method, we got this very early prediction of the most likely time in 2057. Of course, we should not take that year as very serious. It's just around there. There's lots of uncertainty here. So around 2057. And actually, we started this whole work in order to confirm what the IPCC reports present. We wanted to confirm that. And then it was like, that's too early. That's far too early. How can that be? And this was where we really thought there must be something wrong with this moment method, and we worked hard on it. Then when we actually developed this using tools from maximum likelihood estimation and stochastic processes, it turned out that we got the same estimate. Of course, with a lot of uncertainty. And that made us more, it made us more scared because it's an earlier estimate, but it also made us believe more in our estimate. This is why we actually now believe that we're not way off.
And so you found that this could happen, this big change in the Atlantic currents could happen around mid-century. That's maybe the most probable. But there's a wide range of uncertainties, you say, because, well, for one thing, the world is warming and the Arctic is warming even faster than that, all sorts of factors. But your range of possibilities went from as early as 2025, which is just 2 years from now, all the way up to 2095. So somewhere in that period. But I think the media kind of leapt on it and went, well, hey, this could happen this decade even. Do you think that is possible, or is that just a rare possibility?
That's a rare possibility. Of course, it's possible, but it's a rare possibility. So this is the thing about it. We were giving a 95% confidence interval, what we call it. So it's saying that is where, given the data and given the model, so there are more uncertainties, and these uncertainties are very difficult to quantify. Given that, we give this 95% confidence interval, but there's not the same probability for any point in that confidence interval. So the big chunk of probability lies around mid-century, so around, let's say, 2060, from 2040 to 2080 or something like that. That's where we believe it would happen, given that we continue the way we do. So what we call this business as usual scenario. And the business as usual scenario is that we continue increasing greenhouse gas emissions at the same speed as we do now. So, of course, if serious measures are being taken, and at least that seems like what many governments around the world and people are really trying to do, and we reduce it, then we do not believe in our own estimate. So it is kind of business as usual, which corresponds to the worst scenario of the IPCC prediction. So that is kind of comforting if we believe that we can actually change how we act such that global warming can be diminished. Then these estimates will be different.
In the real world, as we wrap up here, in our daily lives, what should listeners take away from your new work and the whole fear of a big change in the North Atlantic?
I think the first take-home message is that this could happen much earlier than we thought. And I think this is one part of the climate, and this is a very important part. But, of course, there are a lot of other problems with global warming, and we have seen that this summer with all the extreme heats and fires and stuff like that. So that has nothing to do with the AMR, but that has to do with global warming. So I think the first take-home message is yet another argument for this is serious now. We have to stop greenhouse gas emissions now. So it's kind of, I wouldn't say wake-up call, because these wake-up calls have been again and again. I mean, it's all over. But I really hope that this can be yet another serious message that we have to change. I don't want to use fear in people. I don't think that is a good thing. I mean, we also need to act, and if we are too scared, we cannot act. And of course, we have to do it on all levels. So I really believe that we cannot really have serious reductions unless governments, especially in the big countries, that they actually do something. But I think we should do something at all levels, also on a personal level, and for various reasons. First of all, because from a psychological point of view, I think it can help us to do something, to feel that we do something for this. Secondly, I think that if we want to put pressure on the politicians, I mean, the politicians are just, I mean, they are just a product of who we elect. I mean, they cannot do anything if they don't have votes. So if they feel a pressure from people, that will also bring a political change, I think. And from that point of view, I think it's very important that we also do something on a personal level. So I do think that we have come to a time in this climate crisis that we have, that we really have to act on all levels, on the personal level, on the political level, on the industrial level. I must say, I have actually recently have become quite optimistic about certain things. We have had in Denmark, we've had some meetings between scientists and in industry. And what struck me was that there are lots of big players in the industry that are really doing huge measures to change